Adam versus et al. Versus Auto and Owners Insurance. And I have Douglas J. Klingberg representing Auto and Owners Insurance. Morning. You may proceed.
Please, the court. The defendant contends that reliance on an express policy provision permitting arbitration is not purposeful conduct designed to avoid payment. Further, when there is no money due or no contract benefit has been established, the issues under the policy are fairly debatable. Defendant, or rather plaintiff, to the contrary, contends the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing arises before and is independent of any contract obligation to pay a benefit. This duty of good faith, we are told, creates a fiduciary-like duty to investigate, to evaluate, and to negotiate. And it's these extra contractual duties that must be discharged in good faith, or an insurer faces the risk of a bad faith claim. Plaintiff has argued it, trial court approved it, court of appeals affirmed it, and they are contrary to the insurance contract, contrary to the principles of bad faith law in Wisconsin, and contrary to sound public policy. This court, in its de novo review of the denial of petitioner's JNOV motion, should reverse and dismiss plaintiff's case. Necessarily, the starting point for any assessment of bad faith is the contract of insurance. It is, after all, the contract terms which establish the benefit which the tort of bad faith seeks to protect, we are told, from vexatious denial or being unreasonably withheld. This first-party bad faith case deals with underinsured motorist coverage. What is it? Basically, the insurance company, in exchange for a premium, agrees to make payment on the happening of certain contingent events. That first contingent event is that there exists an underinsured motorist tortfeasor.
All right, counsel, I'm going to interrupt just for a moment.
Certainly. Because,
understanding that there was an auto accident in 1990, and then there was a action started about roughly 13 months later. My question is this, understanding that Dairyland had $25,000 worth of insurance, and then there were negotiations with Auto Owners Council and Dairyland's Council as to keeping the claim under $25,000, that seemed to have some influence on what the trial court at least thought was bad faith. But after you were notified of the claim, what action did Auto Owners take? What did they do?
Sure. I'm not sure if I understand when notified of the claim. They were notified of the accident fairly soon.
Accident, yes. And then,
following the accident, having been notified, they appointed an adjuster, did so promptly,
right,
undertook to investigate and started making payments for property damage and for medical expenses. And they continued to make those payments for the period of 1 year, the contractual obligation period. They were informed again, I believe it was in May of 1991, by counsel for plaintiff, that there existed the potential for a UIM claim, at which point Having been so advised, they requested, send us your medical records. This is news to us. What do you have? 7 months later, they got those medical records. At that point in time, there had been no payment whatsoever. Dairyland indeed continued to contest their exposure on the underlying coverage for a period of some 4+ years. What happened during that period of time? That there was notice of a potential claim is something that was second-guessed throughout the case and held up against the standard of, was it done in good faith? And my whole point is that second-guessing, looking at what was done in that period of time before the uninsured motorist coverage was activated, it having been activated when payment was made in June, I believe it was, of 1994. At that point, where the underinsured motorist coverage was activated, what happened? We had been kicked out of the right to arbitrate. We had been told by order of the court to sit on our hands. But once the UIM coverage was activated, the arbitration proceeding was reinstituted. A court's and arbitrator's scheduling order was imposed. That imposed scheduling order was followed.
All right, so at that point, excuse me for interrupting, just so I follow this, at that point in time, and we're bringing forward, you made an offer of $10,000, as I recall. I mean, and you had these medicals, and then the arbitration came down for $220,000, and then you paid $196,000, holding back the $25,000 for clarification whether or not the $25,000 at Dairyland kicked in. Now, at that point in time, did you feel that, as far as I can determine whether or not there was any, that you had done everything you could, you had offered the 10, they had come back with the 220?
My point is that at that point in time, even at the point in time where the UIM coverage was activated, there did not exist duty to pay. There being no duty to pay, what we did during that interval of time should not have been fly-specked against a standard of good faith and fair dealing. The duty of good faith and fair dealing did not apply until there was a legally determined entitlement to UIM benefits.
Well, this is what bothers me. The usual test for bad faith is that what is absent is a reasonable basis for denying the benefits of the policy. Nothing to do with entitlement. You're supposed to look. Insurance company is supposed to look at everything it knows about or has reason to know. And you, the insurance company, will be liable for bad faith if there is absent a reasonable basis for denying benefits of the policy. And on the basis of the insurance company's knowledge or reckless disregard of the lack of reasonable basis for denying the claim. Now, when assuming that this was all investigated, you know you've got an underinsured motorist tortfeasor. Coverage is only $25,000, right?
We know it at the point that it's paid in June of 1994.
Well, let's just say here, you know before that, I mean, you've got somebody who is claiming significant medical disability as a result of this accident.
Now, hypothetically?
That may be hypothetical.
Hypothetically?
Let's do it hypothetically. $300,000 worth. And the liability looks awfully clear for the tortfeasor. Doesn't have to be 100%, 60% will do. Now, clearly, it seems to me that the insurance company can't hang back and say, hey, we're not going to pay anything until the carrier pays $25,000, the other carrier. clearly the insurance company can't hang back and say, well, we don't know the precise amount of what her damages are, and we're not going to pay until that's determined by arbitration. I mean, if so, then you'd never get bad faith. The insurance company can always hang back. I mean, so it seems to me if I'm right as to what the elements are of bad faith, your position should be that there was a reasonable basis for denying the benefits of the policy, and that you didn't know, or you didn't recklessly disregard, that is, your client didn't recklessly disregard the lack of a reasonable basis. So why are we talking about entitlements?
Well, entitlement is, I have two arguments. And my first argument indeed is that until the contractual conditions are satisfied, those being, one, the UIM coverage is triggered by the existence of an underinsured tortfeasor causing injury, and two, that there be an entitlement, i.e., the insured demonstrates liability, cause, and damages. Until those two things occur, it is indeed my position that the tort of bad faith is not available. Those two contractual provisions being satisfied, there arises the duty of good faith and fair dealing. One can at that point look at what the insurance company does through that scope of good faith and fair dealing, and if they perform in good faith and fair dealing, fine. But if they don't, the bridge from the contractual obligation to the tort of bad faith is the failure to perform. It's the vexatious denial. It's the delay, unreasonably and recklessly or knowingly.
And when was this triggered? When was your first condition triggered?
The first condition was triggered June of 94. Dairyland paid their $25,000 in underlying coverage. At that point, the UIM coverage is activated. Then the question arises, what are the damages? What is due? You have to understand that 4 years after this accident, Dairyland finally pays their underlying coverage is a bolt from the blue to Auto Owners.
Well, now, there was just the trial court seemed to be hanging some of their hat on the fact that there was this discussion, contact, letter, back and forth between your company and Dairyland as far as that they were assessing that there were $22,000 in specials, and you were offering to pay some of the costs to keep this under 25. I mean, that's just what was in the record.
The trial court put a heavy emphasis on it, and on the motion for JNOV, finding that there did indeed, from the very inception of the case, exist this duty of good faith and fair dealing, and found in counsel for Auto Owners' suggestion, maybe we can settle this thing, maybe we can get all these cases behind us by paying something to get it done.
But if you would, just so I understand, if you would have settled, if they would have settled for $22,000, then Auto Owners was out. You didn't owe anything, did you? If I misinterpreted?
Right. Let me, if I may, in a rather indirect way, but I hope address the issue that you raised, because indeed the trial court thought it was very important, and it was argued big time in front of the jury. And it's this. The suggestion that Auto Owners' counsel was willing to pay something to get the case settled and pay under the table, make a payment that was deceitful to avoid a contract obligation, that's the whole argument they make. Number one, Auto Owners can't make a payment other than to a claimant. They can't make a payment unbeknownst, against their rules. They pay to claimants. And what happens when you pay to claimants? You get a release. There's no way Auto Owners is going to, some sub under the table fashion, make a payment and sneak out from its contract obligations. They're going to make a payment if they do and get a release.
Yeah, but
everybody's going to know that.
That's not consistent with the letter that was written in May of 94. Because in that letter, they didn't talk about paying the claimant. They talked about giving money to your company to help defray costs.
I know what the letter says, and it's discomforting to me, but I don't know what's going on in counsel's mind. I do know this from his perspective. This case has been hanging out there 4 years. He knows what the medical records show. He's been at some of the depositions. There's a big cause question. And Dairyland is sitting on it, not paying, because they don't think there's a causal nexus. And he says, let's get this whole thing behind us. Now, his letter may be inartful, but it's not a premise for deceit. There's nothing that's worthy of blame or criticism for what was done. An attempted settlement. What's wrong with attempting to settle a disputed claim? The argument is advanced by the Court of Appeals that arbitration was used by auto owners to oppress the insured and cause delay. The Court of Appeals is wrong on both counts. What is arbitration? Arbitration is the insured's protection against delay. Arbitration is the insured's voice, the insured's right. I want to be heard. And arbitration provides an absolute right to move the claim handling process forward in a good forum, expeditiously, and fairly to all. Court of Appeals was also wrong that arbitration was used as a mechanism to cause delay, and that auto owners did nothing for years. I've alluded to what auto owners did do early on.
And here it clearly was, just to set the stage, the insured is the person that asks for the arbitration. That's clear here.
Yeah. The insured did in this case.
Yeah.
As the insured had the right to do. Although I would say this, the insured certainly had the right initially to ask for arbitration, but once it has put the case into litigation, I would question whether they have that right to again seek arbitration. I think they've waived, to auto owners' credit, they did nothing in the way of insisting on that. There was a 4-year period from the accident to payment of the underlying coverage that was not of auto owners' making. There was another delay of 1 year after that payment, which was not of auto owners' making. Had auto owners not been kicked out of the litigation, this whole matter would have been resolved in June of 1994, not July of 1995. The first delay was the making of Dairyland's failure to pay, which was their right, and I think reasoned. The second delay of 1 year to conclusion was a delay occasioned by the plaintiff. At the outset, I referenced why the contract of insurance, or the decision, rather, of the Court of Appeals was contrary to the insurance. The Court of Appeals decision is also contrary to Wisconsin case law. I think there are three main issues that the Court of Appeals raised, and there is clear Wisconsin precedent addressing all three of those issues. The first issue is, when does the duty of good faith and fair dealing arise? The second, when does the duty to pay arise in a UIM case? The third, what is fairly debatable as a matter of law? Let's take a look at each of those three issues. The first issue, when does the duty of good faith and fair dealing arise? Anderson addresses the case clearly. In Anderson, there was a duty to pay because the proof of loss had been submitted, indeed submitted twice and rejected twice, and the insurance company did nothing. At the point Anderson was decided, there was not in Wisconsin the tort of good faith. There was not a duty to avoid bad faith. There was not a tort of bad faith. What Anderson did is to bridge the gap from a contract duty to pay to a tort if the good faith and fair dealing found in every contract is not performed. Good faith and fair dealing was the bridge to get from a contract duty to a tort of bad faith. Good faith and fair dealing was the eyepiece that courts used to look at performance of a contract duty. Anderson is clear that until there exists a duty to pay, to talk about a duty of good faith and fair dealing is inappropriate. Second question, when does the duty to pay arise in a UIM case? Bradlin is clear. Bradlin arose where a underinsured motorist, presumably one party, one vehicle accident, underinsured motorist, quote unquote, underinsured motorist sues bus company, sues the driver of the vehicle in which she's a guest passenger. Before the case is tried, after the first day of trial, plaintiff settles the case. Plaintiff then seeks to get all of the UIM coverage that it had available. And the Redland court says, wrong. You did not prosecute sufficiently to establish entitlement. You're gone. Third question. What is fairly debatable in the UIM context as a matter of law? James addresses it and decides it. The workers' compensation claimant has a disability benefits cut off at a point in time where the workers' comp claimant still has a right to be heard, still has an opportunity to present a case, and furthermore, and more importantly for here, I believe, there was in existence a medical opinion that says there's no disability and none exists. Reasonably debatable in an opportunity to be heard.
Was that the case here? What was the medical opinion here?
The medical opinion here that came forward by Dr. Tambornino in February of 1995 was cause was a big question. And from his perspective, cause was not there. Cause was not there based on medical records, based on his examination, based on the history that he obtained from the patient.
So you had, and I may be mistaken, but did you have the reports of three treating physicians before that? I mean, 2 or 3 years before that time?
Yes, there were, there were reports, and there were some, in some circumstances, depositions. There was still a fact issue as to what they understood, what medical records they had available to them, and in that sense, reasonably debatable for a fact finder. Thank you.
Well, let me say that there, as I see it, various ways of approaching this case. One, you could take the position that bad faith never exists in a UIM coverage, that you really represent the tortfeasor, and the whole thing is shifted so you don't have a first-person issue, and so it's never, never in this picture. Is that your position?
It is not my position that a tort of bad faith in a UIM case can never exist. It is my position that it cannot exist until contractual prerequisites are satisfied.
When can it exist in a UIM? What bad faith?
Right. When there has been determined a legal entitlement to impose a duty of good faith before then, as I've alluded to, would be contrary to the contract, would be contrary to Wisconsin law, and I think it would be contrary to sound public policy. Because if you're going to insert a duty of good faith and fair dealing before there exists a contractual duty to pay, you're going to have what you had here, a second guessing of every decision, and every bit of conduct engaged in by the insurance company. Courts are not well equipped to do that, to do the second guessing. And to do the second guessing is going to chill an adversarial relationship.
Well, let me see if I can summarize your argument. Bad faith doesn't exist until there's a legal entitlement, which is the language used, and that means when the insurance company is required by law to pay. Here, at the conclusion of arbitration, you were required to pay $200,000 plus, and at least you weren't required to pay until the tortfeasor was established as being underinsured, and that it paid, so you had liability coverage. That's your guts of your argument. Now, in this case, you delayed investigation, or disrupted investigation, and held off making your own decisions about this until arbitration was done, and until and indeed the court halted discovery, right?
No, not at all.
Didn't the court order say you didn't have to discover while there was arbitration?
The court ordered that, but there was significant discovery
before.
Had been accomplished before that.
But there may be things that happen during this period in which entitlement is decided that a jury might find you didn't do enough. But that's your position is the jury can't find that.
Because that's correct.
All right. Is it your position that bad faith can't exist when the parties submitted to arbitration until the arbitration is concluded?
It's my position. Bad faith is designed to protect an insured's interest in having something he's reasonably entitled to paid promptly without vexatious delay. Until that is decided, what he's entitled to, what the insured is entitled to. In the UIM context, that occurs after legal entitlement, after arbitration, as controlled by the insured or agreement. And I would say most of the time, there is agreement. It's only rarely there is arbitration. The system works. And to impose on that system that works a second guessing that's going to chill the advocacy of clients and is going to insert courts into a posture of supervising that whole process is inappropriate.
Well, another position you might take is that in this case, negligence, causations, and damages were fairly debatable, and that therefore, as a matter of law, it shouldn't have gone to the jury.
That is an argument that I have. It's a position that I've advanced in the briefs, and I believe in it. I do think, first...
Is it consistent with your legal entitlement position?
It is. It is an obligation of the insured under the UIM coverage. Wisconsin case law is clear. Bradlin is clear that the insured has the obligation to establish liability and damages. The contract provides that if we can't agree to that, let's have somebody decide it for us. We can't have a delay. We furnish the mechanism to avoid delay, namely arbitration. When we got to arbitration, we had the right to debate the issues that were there, and those issues were all reasonably debatable. There can't be, when you have something worthy of reasoned debate, bad faith. Bad faith doesn't arise in this case until after arbitration, but if you're going to look at what happened before, it was reasonably debatable. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Summer, representing Darcy K. Danner et al.
Good morning. arbitration so much that that is why the legal department over in Lansing, Michigan instructed Mr. McElhenney on June 23rd of 1993 by letter which is in evidence, leave it in litigation. Because that really comported with their desires in this case. Their desire in this case was to disenfranchise Darcy Danner if they could do so. The way I look at this case, first of all, is that in both motions after verdict, in their arguments in the appellate court and in their arguments in this court, Auto Owners has, on the one hand, said that what they're doing is putting forward a JNOV posture, and on the other hand, they're attacking the verdict and saying that there wasn't adequate evidence that the jury can consider to come to a conclusion that there was bad faith, as the jury did. Now, if I understand, hearkening back to my professor in civil procedure, Professor Conway, what I remember about JNOV and what I have refreshed my recollection about in recent days is that if you're going to call this a JNOV procedure, you are going to take the verdict as proper. And I think the whole question of whether or not the jury had reasonable grounds to conclude that there was bad faith here, that there was adequate evidence to support that finding, is a dead issue. That's a done deal. Now, what their posture should be, I think, if they want to proceed on the JNOV theory, is that despite the jury, in spite of it, they want a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, because the compelling and controlling law in Wisconsin is that a UIM insurer has absolutely no obligation to do anything for its insured in the way of investigation, in the way of evaluation, or in the way of negotiation until there is some kind of either jury verdict or arbitration award, and that there can't be bad faith before that time.
Counsel, let me ask him that. So, just going back to the facts, you have the 90 accident, you have the 91 filing, you have, then you go into arbitration. You're in arbitration, and at what point are you saying that Auto Owners should have offered something, offered a payment? When they were in arbitration, what should they have done there?
Well, first of all, let me just say make one point as a preliminary to that, Judge. Legal entitlement occurs when that policy is provided to the insured and the insured pays a premium. That's where legal entitlement comes from. Now, these are contracts of adhesion. As motorists, we don't have the opportunity to bargain as to the terms. We don't even know what the terms are in most cases until the policy is delivered and we get it as we find it. And that's why we construe these things most strongly against the maker.
But there is a difference. I mean, don't you agree, between I'm owning a policy, Auto Owners insures me, and UIM or UM, where you have to go through, it depends upon what happens with some other insurance company like Dairyland, as far as the quote obligation owed to your insurer.
No, I don't agree with that. I don't think it does depend on anything like that. The insured buys this coverage because they want to protect themselves and their passengers and their family members from the motorist that runs around with minimum limits and wants to protect themselves against damages that far exceed $25,000 or $50,000 in the case of multiple injured. But certainly, The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is in that contract. And that means they've got to get out and they have got to investigate early on, they've got to evaluate, and they've got to negotiate. Now,
well, how could they negotiate here? I'm talking about after they got into arbitration. How could they negotiate?
After you're in arbitration?
Well, they're in arbitration, and as opposing counsel said, we were kicked out.
They were a party to the lawsuit initially.
I'm just repeating what this is what he said.
Well, maybe he and I have a slightly different view of the facts here. They were in the lawsuit to begin with. There was a stay of proceedings. We had sought, and there's correspondence in the record on this, we had sought their agreement to go into arbitration. We didn't learn until we got into the bad faith discovery that the reason that they wouldn't agree to that is because Mr. McEldowney had been instructed by Lansing, leave it in litigation. They didn't want to go into arbitration. But when we put them on notice on May 13th of 91 that their underinsured limits were exposed, if they don't have any duty to do anything before then, they sure as heck have it then. Because now they've been told by plaintiff's counsel, we've looked at this case, we've got 22,000 plus in medicals and 25,000 limits on a driver that made a sudden left turn in front of Our Lady, supported by three eyewitnesses who say he never put on his turn signals, that she was driving at a prudent speed, and that he made a sudden and abrupt left turn in front of her so that she couldn't avoid him. And we have said in those circumstances, liability is a given here, and damages are certainly going to exceed with a discectomy that she's had. Dr. Gemeiner's performed a discectomy on her because of her herniated disc. Damages are certainly going to exceed $25,000. You guys are exposed. That was May 13th of 1991. Now on May 17th of 1993, Mr. McEldowney, auto owner's declared agent, writes and says in his case analysis, it's 90-10 against the tortfeasor. 90-10 on liability against the underinsured driver. She's got 22,000 plus in medical bills, and any jury verdict is certainly going to exceed that amount. And I believe it has a potential in damages of $45,000. Now that's May 17th of 93. Then the guy, Mr. McEldowney, writes his lawyer in the legal department over at Lansing and says, Miss O'Brien, Barbara O'Brien, lawyer for Darylin, is getting ready to pay her policy limits, and I'm trying to talk her out of it. And I'm sure that auto owners would be willing to contribute something here so that it would appear that we have a settlement that is less than $25,000, thereby depriving Miss Danner of any UIM benefits. Is that a deliberate tort? That is what Mr. Klingberg chooses to call good lawyering. God forbid. And then,
well, I don't understand, counsel. What is the bad faith that occurred here?
Bad faith?
Yeah, what's the bad faith? What are the acts that make up bad faith?
They've got three eyewitnesses that they've got statements from.
Right.
And they don't disclose those to us. Now, we know what those people have got to say. They're eyewitnesses to this accident. They're insisting at this point in time, Mr. McEldowney is, repeatedly in correspondence, that Darcy Danner can be held to be liable for this accident. And that's why they're not willing to pay anything. They don't make an offer even in the face of that letter of McEldowney's until December of 94, at which time they offer $10,000.
Well, let's assume for a moment, I guess maybe I'm unclear as to the law, how it would regard in this hypothetical, but let's leave UIM or UM out of it. Let's assume that Darcy Danner sues the Dairyland, you know, puts in a claim against Dairyland, as she did here. Now, Dairyland, as I understand it, has the absolute right to say no and put her to the proof without being accused of bad faith, don't they?
Sure. It's a third-party contract. It's not a first-party contract like this is.
But if we are in a UIM or UM coverage policy, putting the insurance company, the UIM insurance company, in the shoes of the tortfeasor, why don't they have the same right? Your answer apparently is it's
because they're not in the same shoes.
Well, they're in an adversary position, sir.
No, they are not in an adversary position. They can take in an arbitration or in a trial. They have those defenses that are available to, say, Dairyland. They have those defenses. But that does not in any way denigrate their duties as a first-party insurer.
Well, what are their duties? To make an offer? What if they say, and as I suspect they did here, to themselves anyway, gee, this Darcy Danner, there's just no causal connection between her injuries and this accident. Those injuries were all caused by her prior three accidents. This is just a... This just is not a good claim in this instance. They have the right to say that, don't they? And to refuse to even make an offer.
No, they don't. That would be absurd in the face of the medical proof in this case, where you have two doctors testifying under oath. One's a treating doctor, an orthopod, Dr. Langheim. The other is Dr. Geminer, who operated on her. Plus, you've got Dr. Samanda and Dr. Fultz, all of whom say this accident caused this herniated disc and she needed the surgery. These guys go out 5.5 years later and get this guy Tambernino from Eau Claire or somewhere on what's a defense medical examination, and he says, well, in a written report, they didn't even bring him to the arbitration hearing because of this, I'm sure. He says, well, her current problems don't seem to be related to the accident. Doesn't seem like she really needed this surgery in light of her injuries. And he doesn't state it to the requisite evidentiary standard. That's why they didn't bring him, I'm sure. He doesn't say that to a reasonable medical probability. And this is 5.5 years later, where she's had her medical behind her within 2 years of the date of the accident. Now, what I'm saying to you, Justice Bablich, is that as a UIM insured on your car, if you get hit by some fellow with $25,000 and you're laying there in the hospital bed with a bad back, and you roll up $25,000 or so, or short of it, in medicals, you have every right to go to your own insurance company with whom you have contracted and paid a premium and from whom you deserve fair treatment, not obfuscation and frustration, and say to them, okay, you guys are exposed on this. Now, I want you to evaluate this, and I want you to make a reasonable offer here.
And if they don't, she's entitled, if I say that, and they, and like my insurance company says no, I'm entitled to go to arbitration, right there.
And all the time, you are supposed to be working with these people to fairly settle this claim. And we're hearing $10,000 offers in the face of all of this? You know, that's bad faith on it, standing alone. You know what Anderson tells us, and I agree that Anderson is certainly the state of the law. Whether a claim is fairly debatable, and that has to be what you're talking about, I think, also implicates the question whether the facts necessary to evaluate the claim are properly investigated and developed, or recklessly ignored and disregarded. Now, auto owners didn't do a darn thing on this, and you may recall the letter in which the Green Bay claims manager says, some 3 years down the road, you know, we put this thing on the back burner. Why? Because they thought they might get out with no UIM exposure.
Well, it strikes me that your argument is as follows. Your client bought an underinsured motorist coverage, paid a premium for it. That's why we're into a first party rather than a third party situation. That it's a little complicated because some of our cases say that underinsured motorist coverage is really paying for the tortfeasor's coverage for yourself. You say, well, that doesn't really apply here, it's first party, and then what you do is see if there's been good faith attempt at paying this policy. So you have a situation first of liability. And then your answer to that is, well, when you look at the records here and you look at the eyewitnesses report, looks like the alleged tortfeasor is over 50%. So liability is not really fairly debatable. I mean, that's your position, isn't it?
I think in all the facts that they knew or could have developed, that it was not fairly debatable.
And you want them to develop him right away, then not sit around and wait for Dairyland to pay out $25,000 and not sit around and wait for arbitration to be finished.
Sure. And I proposition that you can go ahead and get this UIM exposure dealt with, even though the initial tortfeasor, the underinsured motorist, even though that thing hasn't come to an end. And the case law also tells us that the mere fact that eventually you pay does not relieve you of the peril you have placed yourself in if you have failed to investigate, evaluate, and negotiate.
Okay.
You are still liable.
You're liable because we've got liability established, but now we got a real causal, it looks like a causal problem here.
On the medical, you mean?
Pardon me?
On the medical.
On the medical. Your client has had 3 auto accidents in a relatively short period. She's got back problems. And then the question is, did this, the accident we're talking about here, further complicate these problems? Or didn't do anything to your client, and it's the same old problem she had before? So, isn't that fairly debatable?
I hardly think so. I think the fairly debatable question has been answered by the jury.
Well, the jury has said that they were not fairly debatable.
That whole issue was tried, Your Honor, and to the jury. I mean, this isn't something that's just come up since the jury verdict. That is, the jury heard from Mr. Klingberg, this is fairly debatable. The jury gets instructions on all that. And the jury was obviously convinced on the evidence that they heard that there wasn't any question about what happened here. And if they can see that as laypersons sitting on that jury, what is this, something new to auto owners? Have they never handled a UIM claim before?
Counsel, when is the UIM carrier's duty to pay triggered?
Well, triggered, I think, is a misnomer as well, but if what you mean is when are they required to make some sort of offer?
No, when is the duty to pay triggered?
Well, the duty to pay can arise before the completion of an arbitration. It can arise before a jury verdict. It can arise before the determination of the underlying tortfeasor's liability or the amount of damages is determined.
How so, under the contract?
Well, that happens to be the case under Myers versus Classified Insurance. And there is no problem with these people if they have some question in their mind. Then let them do as we ask them to do. Tender what you think is correct.
Sure. I understand that they can under the case law, but when must they? Which is what this case is really all about. When is that duty triggered?
I think they must the moment that they have at hand the information sufficient to analyze the liability aspects of the case and the damage aspects of the case. And when they know those, as they did or should have known here, then they have a duty to make a tender.
But if the law says that the UIM carrier has the right to assert all defenses on liability and damages that would be possessed by the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance carrier, then how can we also, isn't it contradictory of that to impose a duty to pay before that time occurs?
If you want to put them in the third-party shoes...
Well, it's not whether I want to put them in the third-party shoes. It's what the law says.
If that's the way your question is going, then look at it this way. Aren't the vast majority of auto accidents third-party situations? Do you think that because there is someone insuring a negligent tortfeasor that it's not likely that the insurance carrier can evaluate that claim and make an offer?
No, I'm agreeing with you that can happen.
Well,
talking about what the law requires, which is what we're all about here. What does the contract require, and how is it analyzed in the context of the case law?
And
the case law says that the UIM carrier has all those defenses at its disposal. And if that's the case, I mean, we have to reconcile that with this tort of bad faith, because the two lines of cases and the two legal theories are in conflict with each other, and I'm asking you for a way to reconcile that. Other than saying, yeah, they can do it, but, you know, when, at what point must they?
Well, I would suggest to you, Justice Sykes, that you take a look at the Anderson case from beginning to end. I think it's all laid out there. And essentially, it holds that the intentional tort of bad faith requires the insured show the absence of a reasonable basis for denying benefits. And I, that's what this fairly debatable stuff's all about. But again, I hearken back to the point that this was decided by the jury. And on JNOV, you don't go back and look at that.
But it seems to me you have to, if you're going to prevail, you'd have to say that, okay, you have, auto insurance has the right to state all the defenses. But because it's a first party issue, it has an obligation of bad faith. That is a good faith. That as soon as they know, or should have known, it really is reckless disregard, it's not negligence. As soon as they know that there is no reasonable basis to deny the claim, that is when the duty to pay arises. And that, so if they have, on the basis of their information, they believe it was 60-40 in terms of negligence, and they believe that the damages were in a range of A to B, that they have an obligation then to tender, to pay in the range of the damages A to B, less the contributory negligence. And that, that's their obligation on good faith. Now, they could be a little wrong on the damages. They can be ultimately a little wrong on the negligence, since there are ranges in all this. But that's when their obligation to pay or tender a payment starts. Now, then they can fight about how much, but once there's a tender in a reasonable range, then good faith has been demonstrated.
Yes, ma'am.
Does that make any sense?
I beg your pardon?
Does that make any sense? Is that what you're arguing?
I like that argument a great deal.
Thank you.
Very well said. The point is that that auto owners cannot deprive, Justice Sykes, its insured of that which they, that security that they bargained for. They're looking for protection against that underinsured motorist. And they paid a premium for that. And therefore, once they know of the claim, auto owners has got to get on that thing and get after it. And they've got to start dealing fairly with their insurer so that they don't frustrate that security that the plaintiff has sought in this coverage. And in that sense, that's first party.
Oh, no, I don't disagree. This is a first party situation.
But
and
if you agree with that, you very much a lot more than you have to agree with.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think we do have to reconcile the apparent conflict between the tort of bad faith and the situation that the UIM carrier is in under the case law, which is that it has the ability to assert all those defenses that are available to the tortfeasor, and the duty to pay under the contract isn't triggered until the status of the tortfeasor is determined to be that of an underinsured motorist.
Do you have any doubt there was bad faith here?
Well, you're the one answering the question,
well,
not me. So, there's a smoking gun letter, I will grant you that, and that'll be my first question to you.
What do you think about a lawyer that goes to Dairyland and says, don't don't pay your limits. We'll give you some money so this will look like less than policy.
Looks really bad. And there might be some other tort that covers that.
Is that depriving their insured of the security that they bargained for? I mean, come on. We got 12 people in Rhinelander who heard this.
Well, is that actionable in some other way outside the context of the tort of bad faith?
You could, I suppose, sue in contract if you wish, but we elected to go in bad faith. I mean, you do have a contract clause as well as a deliberate tort, an intentional tort. But there's no need to assert both of those. Well, you can go with one or the other.
Before we conclude, I have a question about the damages, assuming you get over the issue here. The damages that the jury awarded was what, about $125,000, give or take some money?
Yes.
And that didn't fit into any, that $125,000 the jury awarded did not fit any of the evidence per se. That is, the attorney fees for the bad faith claim was whatever that was. What was that?
The whole thing. One of them was about $81,000. That was the underlying, and then
right.
The other was more than $125,000. Right. It was $145,000 or something.
Well, it looked as if the jury was not willing to award both and did some compromise on that. And the judge, the trial judge said, no, that's not supported by the evidence, and so the trial judge awarded what?
He awarded the full amounts
full
of the attorney's
fees. Okay. Can you defend that?
Sure. There was absolutely no evidence offered by the defense to refute the amounts of the attorney's fees. You will look in that record in vain to find anything where they put in some proof from somebody who could take the stand and say, oh, that's too much, they charge too much, that isn't fair, it isn't reasonable. There's nothing like that. They went absolutely unrefuted, and the Court of Appeals noted that in its decision.
Okay, counsel, sorry.
I'm done.
Pardon me?
I'm done.
Thank you.
Thank you,
I'm done,
Mr.
Too.
Summers. Mr. Klingberg?
Let's look at what the jury did. Let's take a look at the verdict. They awarded no attorney fees, none, for the underlying arbitration. There's one reasonable inference to draw from that. Because what happened at arbitration was a contract right, and the issues were reasonably debatable. That's what the jury found. There are some policy issues that need to be addressed in this case, and I think Anderson is a starting point, because I think Anderson answers the question about when does the duty of good faith arise. This whole trial was about one thing,
just
the duty.
One question on arbitration, did the jury, well, this may be answered, but the jury feel that your client, Auto Owners, was involved in the arbitration? Did they feel, you, as I say, you were not... They asked for arbitration, and as far as the participation of your client in that, you're saying that they awarded no attorney fees.
That's correct.
Yeah. So the attorney fees were awarded for what?
The attorney fees were awarded my interpretation. The jury filled in the blank.
Yes.
Attorney fees for the bad faith action.
Correct.
My interpretation of why they did that is they concluded what was done was fair. These folks got what they had coming to them. Let's not make them pay the attorney fees incurred in prosecuting a bad faith action. That's my interpretation of what they did. When does the duty of good faith arise? It arises, according to Anderson, when there exists a contractual benefit due and owing to the plaintiff. The second policy issue this court should address has to do with whether or not there's a fiduciary relationship that exists in the UIM case. There's a really excellent article in the 1999-2000 Kentucky Law Journal, 88 Kentucky Law Journal, number one, authored by an individual by the name of Douglas Richmond, in which he talks about fiduciary duty. and how the fiduciary duty doesn't fit at all into a relationship that is essentially adversarial in nature. That you can't owe the highest duty of good faith and fair dealing to an insured, if you're an attorney, and on the other hand, zealously represent your client. To impose fiduciary in a third-party adversarial relationship is to dampen the ardor of an attorney representing a client. It's to insert yourself into that relationship, and it's to invite second-guessing, such as we had here, throughout the whole procedure.
Counsel, how would that be benefited when you have correspondence between yourself and Dairyland suggesting a resolution of the case? That's what I'm talking about, this adversarial position that you have. But I can't imagine that would take in that type of correspondence.
Well, I think you're referring to the correspondence from Attorney McElvowney. Yes, sir. From Attorney McElvowney to Attorney O'Brien. Attorney McElvowney is in a position where he's representing the client, where there is going to be coming, perhaps down the road, a claim for uninsured motorist. Attorney McElvowney owes a duty to one person in that context. That's auto owners. I would contend and I would argue, till I'm blue in the face, that by its very nature, you can't have anything other than an adversarial relationship. It stands to reason. What does an insured want with a UIM coverage? As much as they've got coming as soon as possible. That's what they want. Nothing wrong with it. What is the insurance company concerned with, and what do they need to do? They need to make sure that there's a valid claim, that it's not fraudulently made. They need to do that to protect the public, to protect the industry. And then they need to find out if it's a covered claim. Is it an uninsured motorist claim or not? And they should do that unencumbered by courts looking at and second-guessing what they're doing. They're better able to do that than courts. And thirdly, there needs to be a concern as to what's the value. Do we have issues here that are worthy of litigation? Is it reasonably debatable? This court should make clear for the attorneys and the trial courts in the state that UIM and UM coverage is adversarial by its very nature. It should protect, because it's adversarial, the rights of counsel to represent their insurance companies, unimpaired by some fiduciary-like duty.
So we shouldn't even attempt to reconcile the insurance company's first-party obligations to its insured with its third-party-like rights under the UIM case law. We should just say that those first-party obligations don't even start until the duty to pay is triggered under the contract.
The first-party obligation under any first-party coverage is one thing, and that's the duty to pay when the contract conditions are fulfilled. They were fulfilled in Anderson when the proof of loss landed on the insurance company's desk. They were fulfilled here when the arbitration came back.
Could you clarify for me exactly what it is that you're asking the court to do?
I'm asking for this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and dismiss the plaintiff's complaint. And how do they get to that point?
No attorney's fees at all?
Correct. Dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint is the relief that I seek.
So the jury's verdict on the $125,000, that disappeared?
Correct.
What do you think the consequence would be if this court goes along with that in
the
terms
consequence,
of conduct by insurance companies?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What do you think the consequences of such a request being granted would be on the future conduct of insurance companies?
I think in the future, insurance companies, knowing that they could deliberate and decide according to a discharge of their responsibilities as an insurance company without threat of being mulcted or extorted would be favorable to everybody. If, on the other hand, you're going to permit trial courts to look at this type of case and second-guess every decision, as soon as there's an accident or at least a notice of claim, you're going to raise the specter of bad faith, the risk of bad faith. You're going to invite litigation. You're going to invite plaintiffs to do the setup, such as they did here. You're going to invite litigation with the retrospective hope of being able to establish bad faith. You're going to insert the judiciary into a process where it doesn't belong, because I don't think they are well equipped to decide on a case-by-case basis the issues that an insurance company needs to address and deal with every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klingberg. And thank you, Mr. Summers, and thank you, Mr. Schrader, for the briefs and the argument. That concludes.